You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. A report into the Tillamook County District Attorney and her staff backs up numerous complaints from law enforcement, victims, elected officials, and others. Those complaints alleged lack of competency in court proceedings, failure to consider the safety of victims of crimes, especially those related to sexual assault or domestic violence, and general lack of advocacy for victims. The report was created by retired prosecutor Katie Suver, who was retained as an investigator by the Tillamook County Board of Commissioners last year to look into complaints against the DA's office. Suver interviewed more than a dozen people, as well as deputy district attorneys noted in complaints, and district attorney Aubrey Olson. The report concludes that Olson was inadequate in training and supervising the deputy district attorneys who were investigated, fostered poor relationships with law enforcement agencies, particularly the Tillamook County Sheriff's Office, was indifferent to the work of criminal justice partners designated to support victims, and allowed one deputy DA to persist in a pattern of belittling another employee, including in public meetings. The report also noted a steep drop in the number of cases pursued by the office and the number of cases going to trial since Olson was elected in 2023. After a review of 11 cases from Olson's tenure, the investigator concluded that she felt prosecutors were underprepared and showed a lack of empathy when questioning victims. The report was submitted to the county in February, and the Tillamook Headlight Herald received a redacted version late last week. One interview in the report was with Tillamook County Sheriff Josh Brown, who said he noticed a disturbing trend of instances of what he considered incompetence and negligence. Another person interviewed was Valerie Bundy, Executive Director of Tides of Change, which advocates for and supports survivors of gender-based and sexual crimes. The organization works on several multidisciplinary teams with members of the district attorney's staff. But Bundy and others said that deputy district attorneys were not meeting with victims or other witnesses in advance of trials to prepare them for their testimony. The role of two crime victims' advocates in the DA's office also changed significantly under Olson, according to Bundy. The advocates no longer notified victims about hearings or accompanied victims to court as they had in the past. In both instances, Bundy's staff picked up the slack. Olson was elected as district attorney in 2023. She previously worked with the Memphis Police Department before pursuing a law degree. She graduated in 2015 from Lewis and Clark Law School, then worked as a fish and game trooper. She took and passed the bar in 2018 and began working with the Tillamook County DA's office in 2018 as a volunteer. She was hired in 2019, prosecuting drunk driving cases. In her interview with the county's investigator, Olson acknowledged tensions with law enforcement, but pushed back against the characterizations of how she runs the office and her staff's approach to victims. She defended the decline in cases, saying that many of the cases before would have been dismissed or ended in acquittal, and that she has made much stronger charging decisions. When asked about a seeming lack of credence placed in victims' reports, Olson said that she had seen many cases where it, quote, sure looks like this victim is lying or has an ulterior motive. A deputy district attorney who was interviewed characterized the opposition to Olson as being due to an old boys' club mentality. Even before the investigation concluded, Olson began to fight back, announcing her intent to file a lawsuit alleging interference related to the investigation. In April, she filed subpoenas seeking access to employee records for an unnamed whistleblower. The county is contesting this. Olson did not respond to the Tillamook Headlight Herald's request for comment. The county, in a statement, said it is looking forward to working with the DA's office to address the concerns identified in the report. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. Oregon's free community college program would end under a legislative proposal being considered by the state's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. The Oregon Promise Grant covers the cost of tuition at community colleges. It's open to recent graduates of Oregon high schools regardless of income. But analysis shows it's having a limited impact. Kyle Thomas is the legislative director for the Higher Ed Commission.
In our own research, our Oregon Promise reports show that it has not had a consistent impact on increasing college-going rates or expanding college access as the program was intended.
But Thomas says the grant has made college more affordable for program recipients. The proposal recommends sunsetting the Promise Grant next year and moving its funds to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which directs aid to students who need it the most. Any changes to Oregon Promise would need legislative approval. A sold-out crowd cheered on the WNBA's return to Oregon on Saturday at the Moda Center. The Portland Fire took on the Chicago Sky for the official season opener. Kyra Buckley reports.
19,335 fans showed up to cheer on the Portland Fire even as they lost their home opener to Chicago 98-83. Fans roared at every basket made even though the Fire trailed the Sky most of the game. Head coach Alex Sarama told reporters he was encouraged by the energy his team brought to the court.
We saw glimpses tonight of what we have the potential to be. I think it's just a case of how we can get to that more consistently as a group.
The Portland Fire will record a loss on their record, but the crowd still got a big win. It's the most people ever to show up for a WNBA expansion team's home opener. It beats last year's record set by the Golden State Valkyries. I'm Kyra Buckley reporting.
From national forests to city parks, apple trees planted more than a century ago are still growing throughout the Pacific Northwest. In Central Oregon, an effort is underway to find and uncover the history of each heritage tree. Jen Bidas reports.
It's a bright, crisp spring morning. Peter Laverso and CJ Johnson are deep in the Crooked River National Grassland near Madras.
Watch the barbed wire. I will stand over here.
Build us a little bridge, Peter.
They're making their way over fences and cow patties to search for a handful of tagged apple trees. Laverso, who lives in Bend, begins picking leaves from one gnarled trunk.
This guy looks great.
This tree is in an apple orchard planted in the late 1800s during the state's homesteading era. Laverso places the leaves in a Ziploc bag.
It's not going to hurt the tree, and better to have too many than too few.
He'll send these samples to a lab at Washington State University for DNA testing to see what kind of tree it is and where it came from. Laverso is an amateur cider maker, and he recently found a community of fellow apple lovers after he met CJ Johnson.
Well, you see these old orchards, and they are screaming for attention.
She spies a long-forgotten apple tree with a mess of brittle twigs tangled at the top.
For me as an apple person to look at a tree like that, you know, I just want to get out the pruners and cut.
The two are leaders of the nonprofit Heritage Apple Corps. Johnson started the organization to ensure that the history contained in the twisted branches of trees like these is preserved.
It was also really exciting in that there were other people like me who wanted to keep the history alive and the culture in these orchards.
The core group has 6 members, but they draw out a larger number of volunteers for special events like pruning days. They work through the Forest Service to get permits for reviving and protecting orchards like this one on remote public land. In the 1880s, these very trees were owned by the McCoyne family.
It's kind of a haunting thing to think that when you bite into one of these McCoyne or Cyrus orchard apple trees, you're biting into living history.
Jerry Ramsey is a descendant of the McCoynes and grew up near the old orchards.
When I was a kid, I was no cowboy, but I liked to ride up there just for the sheer fun of riding in those wide open spaces.
On those horseback rides, he remembers stopping to pick apples in the summer. Now in his 80s, Ramsey is a local historian and has worked with Heritage Apple Corps members to trace the lineage of his ancestors' trees. Not every heritage apple tree is in a remote wilderness, though. Some are hiding in plain sight in cities and neighborhoods. Just past an outdoor mall in Bend's Old Mill District, Laverso is running down a tip. He heard there are some old apple trees down by the Deschutes River.
And here they are.
You would totally miss these from the trail, even though they're right off the trail.
Yeah, so one, two, and then three is that.
He ducks under overgrown brush to pick newly sprouted leaves from a trio of trees. He'll know how rare the find is after DNA testing is done. At peak popularity, there were over 17,000 cataloged varieties of apples in the U.S. Today, there are less than half that many. During his forays to look for heritage trees, Laverso's hopeful he'll find a long-forgotten variety.
People have been here since time immemorial, and there's been history happening that whole time. Anybody can come up here, walk among these trees, taste the fruit, and I think there's something magical about that.
The apple core also takes grafts to clone the trees. Laverso has 47 clone saplings at his house, and he's looking forward to planting them in a nearby orchard later this year. He says since apple trees don't usually live over 100 years, the window to save them is closing. I'm Jen Bitus reporting.
The town of Lakeview near Oregon's southern border has fallen on hard times. Major businesses have shuttered and opportunities are scant. Now the town government faces an economic crisis, forcing its residents to step up and fill in the gap. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Joni Auden-Land reports.
Lakeview Public Works foreman Pete Fortune walks into a workshop filled with boxes.
This used to be an old National Guard armory. So
they're filled with thousands of feet of pipe. They were meant for a project to replace water meters in each home, but town officials bought way too much.
We were guessing that they bought 100 foot per house, which that's grossly over, because a lot of the time it only took 10, 12 feet to go from the main to,
So we're talking 10 times the pipe, basically.
Yeah. This is only a small portion of it. There's more in another building.
All these pipes, which the town has no plans to use, are symbolic of a town on the brink of financial collapse. Lakeview is home to more than 2,000 people, just north of the Oregon-California border, and it's faced many challenges in recent years. It took on millions of dollars in loans leaders say they can't afford. A former town manager was accused of mismanaging Lakeview's finances. Drowning in debt, the town cut dozens of jobs, raised fees, and has seen rampant leadership turnover. All this means the town government could become insolvent and continue to cut services. And people here don't have a lot of other options.
When you live apart from the rest of your fellow Oregonians, you figure out you've got to take care of yourselves.
That's Stan Foster, the interim town manager for Lakeview. When he started this job last July, the town had stopped paying its bills and wasn't collecting water payments from residents. Financial records were often missing. And the mood in Lakeview had turned sour.
And what I encountered were people that were pretty downtrodden, had been treated pretty poorly. We didn't have enough personnel, but there was no likelihood we were going to have enough personnel. Beginning of every month, I found that there was another stack of debts that I wasn't aware of.
Lakeview is a long way from anywhere in the middle of the high desert, sandwiched between the Warner Mountains and Goose Lake. Much of downtown is empty storefronts. There are only a couple restaurants and bars. Georgia Getty has lived here her whole life and remembers when Lakeview had more to offer.
And my kids, they really don't have anything to do. When I grew up here, we had dances, we had bowling, we had a theater, we had places to go and things to do and people to see. And now those fun things don't exist anymore.
Okay.
One of the most active places in Lakeview is the downtown cafe and bakery. A group of friends comes here every morning to discuss the town's issues, like the large number of deer.
Yeah, we got more deer in town than we do outside. You know, I got to feed them by hand, and then you walk up again.
And they talk about the city government and the poor shape of the town's economy. William Neal worked at a nearby lumber mill for 42 years. Those kinds of jobs, he says, don't exist here anymore.
It's almost a government and a retirement community, and the economy is very depressed here. It's scary.
In the middle of this scary situation, some people in Lakeview have taken it upon themselves to help out. And because the town cannot afford to hire employees, many people have volunteered to do city jobs for little to no money. That includes IT work, picking up trash, fixing water systems, and payroll. Getty, for example, volunteered to help with city finances. She considers it part of her civic duty.
Everybody needs to kind of pitch in. I don't know where it went sideways at, but we got to get it upright again.
And residents are raising money to pay for their own services. They raised $170,000 to keep the local swimming pool open. One group sold nearly nude calendars to pay for winter snow plowing. Another bright spot is the town's new skate park. The local Rotary Club raised $500,000 thanks to grants and community support. Andrew Rucker helped oversee the project.
This used to be an old, dilapidated tennis court with two courts on it. And we went to the town and said, hey, we'd like to build a skate park here. Will you let us? And so they said, sure, as long as we don't have to build it.
The children took to it immediately, and it's often full. At sunset, parents point their headlights at the park so kids can skate into the evening. People in Lakeview say this is what they love about their town. Everyone knows everybody, and people are willing to step up when someone needs help. Now, they're hoping their local government can do the same and keep their town alive. I'm Joni Auden Land reporting.
Seattle will be swamped with people when the World Cup comes next month. Officials say that's ripe conditions for human trafficking, and they're working to prevent that from happening. KNKX's Anna Marie Yanni has more.
About 750,000 people are expected to visit Seattle for the FIFA World Cup. Those crowds will likely bring lots of business to restaurants and bars and cause more traffic, and potentially cases of human trafficking. All that puts a strain on first responders and frontline workers, such as those working at the airport. Sam Cho is a commissioner for the Port of Seattle. He says port employees are receiving additional training on human trafficking ahead of the event. That includes workers at ship terminals, like where cruises dock.
And many of us are just not aware or don't have the muscle memory to identify it. That's why the training is important.
Signs at the airport and ship terminals have been updated to include 8 different languages. That's to ensure people understand their rights. I'm Anna Marie Yanni reporting.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. That includes news host and production assistant Ava Berardi and me, news director Katie Frankowitz. Find more local and regional news at KMUN.org. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In a stunning decision, May 8th, the Virginia Supreme Court invalidated the April redistricting referendum authorizing new congressional district maps. The court pointed to the state constitution's requirement that amendments be approved twice over 2 terms of the legislature, then by the voters. The 4-3 decision throws a wrench into Democratic efforts to counter gerrymandering of additional GOP congressional seats requested by President Donald Trump in Texas, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, and Florida. Paired with the U.S. Supreme Court's April 29th Calais decision ending protection of majority-minority voting districts, it could artificially throw control of Congress to the Republicans in the midterm elections. In his opinion, Justice D. Arthur Kelsey wrote, "The General Assembly must twice vote in favor of a proposed amendment at 2 separate legislative sessions with an intervening election of the House of Delegates. This gives voters 2 opportunities, one indirect, the other direct, to voice their views on the proposed amendment," unquote. May 7th, Tennessee GOP legislators eliminated a majority-minority district encompassing Memphis. May 8th, Alabama legislators advanced a plan for a new primary election if courts allow that state to also redistrict. More on those developments in our next report. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
This is KMUN.